I'm Tanya Mosley, and I want to thank you for listening to the Here and Now podcast. I also want to ask you to do something. Support your NPR station with a donation right now at donate.npr.org/now. Your contribution supports the reporting you hear every day, the latest from Washington, where a new administration is preparing to take over, and reporting from across the country on the surge of COVID-19 cases. Your donation ensures that you're hearing a range of voices, the experts, and also the everyday people who are experiencing all of this right now, like we all are. You're also helping to make possible those unforgettable interviews with authors, big thinkers, and creatives in the fine arts and popular culture. Those moments that make you want to listen every day. So make a donation to your NPR station now. Your contribution is more important than ever. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now let's get to the news.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we have a deal. And today, the House and Senate are expected to vote on a nearly $900 billion relief package following months of partisan gridlock. Here's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell speaking on the Senate floor last night.
We can finally report what our nation has needed to hear for a very long time. More help is on the way.
And although this new relief package doesn't come close to the $2 trillion CARES Act passed in March, it's still one of the biggest of its kind in U.S. history. Let's bring in NPR's congressional reporter, Claudia Grisales. And Claudia, before we get into the nuts and bolts of this bill, let's acknowledge how anxious the country has been for it. What's the feeling in Washington today?
Perhaps a little more of that here. There's plenty of anticipation, perhaps in part because we haven't seen the legislative text for this massive effort. And the later it gets to see that text, the later we go into the day, perhaps the night, to see potentially both chambers vote on this issue. But putting that aside, there's also some relief that leaders were finally able to reach this deal this month after months of partisan bickering that stretched out, especially over recent days, to finally announce this breakthrough. And that all said, the clock is ticking. This plan has to be approved by midnight, or lawmakers will need another temporary funding measure to avoid a government shutdown. That's because these economic stimulus efforts will be attached to an annual government spending deal. So there's a lot riding on the line right now to beat that midnight deadline tonight to make sure they can get this passed.
That's right. The drama is not over yet. But top of mind for many is direct relief checks from the U.S. government for people who have been struggling through this pandemic. How much can people expect to receive, and how soon could they get it?
They are looking at up to $600 for Americans. This is adults and children, and the timing could be quick once the legislation is approved. Checks were being mailed out within weeks of the legislation gaining approval when we saw direct payments earlier this year. So it's possible we could see a repeat of that again this time around.
How much will go toward unemployment benefits and also the Paycheck Protection Program? That was the loan program for small businesses, which was created in the CARES Act, but it ran dry over the summer.
Yes, we'll see enough to fund $300 extra in weekly unemployment benefits. And we'll see that for about 10 weeks. So this would run from about the end of December to about mid-March right now is what they're estimating. We should also see about $300 billion for small business loans through that Paycheck Protection Program.
And there's a lot of different subcategories here because we see there's money for rental assistance and also money for vaccine distribution. What about details there?
Yes, we do see funding there, billions that will be appropriated for the vaccine distribution and rental assistance. We're looking at $25 billion there. There's also money for hospitals and food security programs, as well as help for schools. This is colleges and grade level schools. All told, this $900 billion plan could arrive as a number of provisions were set to expire at the end of this month, tied to that package passed earlier this year that you mentioned called the CARES Act.
So, Claudia, in the closing hours of this debate in the last few days, it was almost upended by Republican Senator Pat Toomey's effort to put some restrictions on the Federal Reserve. Whatever became of that?
Yes. So Toomey of Pennsylvania, he wanted to limit lending programs for the Federal Reserve. This was triggered by the earlier CARES Act that was passed in March. Democrats said his language was overly broad, and they wanted to make sure President-elect Joe Biden's team could launch similar lending programs with the Fed so they're able to reach an agreement to narrow the impact of that new language in the deal. And both sides were pleased with the outcome. Democrats said it doesn't hurt the future ability to restart lending facilities to respond to a crisis. Well, Toomey told reporters on a call on Sunday that his initial language, he agreed, was too broad.
Wow, a little bit of compromise. All right, just quickly, Amazing. We heard from Mitch McConnell there at the top. Now let's hear from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who had this to say on the House floor this morning.
We will do some good with this legislation, but we must recognize that more needs to be done.
Okay, so we're 2 weeks away from the convening of a new Congress. Claudia, will this be the end of congressional relief for now, now that we've finally got this one over the finish line almost?
Well, Democrats, as you heard Pelosi saying there, really hope this is just the beginning, especially for the Biden administration. He has said repeatedly that he considers this to be a down payment, assuming all goes well in this becomes law this week, that it would be a down payment for future assistance. So the hope is that this will just be the beginning. Republicans, however, it remains to be seen what they'll agree to in the future.
For now, a sigh of relief for many Americans. NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Well, in Europe, several countries have now restricted travel from the UK after a variant of the coronavirus named B117 was reported in the southeast of England, a new strain that seems much more contagious, but not more deadly than the first. There are also reports of a new strain in South Africa. So what's going on? Angela Rasmussen is a virologist with the Georgetown Center for Global Health Science and Security. Hello, Dr. Rasmussen.
Hi, thanks for having me here.
Well, thanks for being here. And we caution there are a lot of unknowns here. Viruses always mutate. Another variant in Spain was once thought to be far more infectious. But when researchers looked closer, it was just a lot of people traveling with it and spreading it. So what does the research you've seen say about the contagion of B117?
So this is what's very, very challenging about trying to understand how individual variants or mutations are contributing to the effects that we're seeing at the population scale. This new variant, B117, seems to be associated with a very rapid increase in prevalence in southeastern England and parts of London. So that suggests that perhaps it may be spreading more quickly because of the virus itself, but we can't exclude the possibility that it also could be because people were relaxing precautions that they were taking to reduce transmission in their communities. We just need to do more research to figure that out. But it is very alarming how quickly this variant has become very prevalent. So that does suggest that there may be something to this beyond people are just behaving differently.
Yeah. Well, how alarming is it? And how, you know, what should people do? We're going to hear later in the program from a trucker who's stuck on the border of the UK because he can't cross into France. And we're hearing that New York's Governor Cuomo here in the U.S. asked British Airways to only fly people who've tested negative for the coronavirus to JFK in New York. And today, British Airways agreed to that. So your thoughts, I mean, how much is stopping travel going to help?
So I don't think actually that stopping travel is going to help very much for a couple of different reasons. I think it's important for people to not travel in general right now because transmission of this variant as well as the other variants that have been circulating is really out of control in many parts of the world and throughout the United States. So it is good in general to not travel. But in terms of this particular variant, we just don't have very much information on whether or not that might already be here. So the UK has some of the best genomic surveillance in the world, meaning that it's very likely that they would detect such a variant before anybody else would. It's entirely possible that this variant is already circulating in the U.S. There's some evidence that it's circulating elsewhere in Europe and potentially around the world that just hasn't been detected yet. The important thing for people to remember is that this virus, this new variant, is transmitted in the same way as all the other variants. So if we are taking precautions to reduce transmission overall, that should address this new variant as well as all the other viruses that we've been dealing with for the past year.
Yeah, wear a mask no matter what. But how might these new strains interact with the vaccine campaigns? I mean, are the vaccines covering new strains of the coronavirus?
So that's one thing that we don't know, but that we urgently need to find out. So this new variant has multiple mutations in the spike protein, which is what the vaccines use to develop immunity against SARS coronavirus 2. Anytime you have a mutation in that protein, there's the possibility that that protein may be different enough to not be recognized by your immune system. So those studies are ramping up right now. Obviously, the entire scientific community understands that this is a very high priority question to answer.
And would the same be true of treatments that have shown to, you know, reduce the amount of illness, for instance, from the coronavirus?
So that would only be likely for the monoclonal antibody therapies. Those monoclonal antibodies work by targeting specific parts of the spike protein. If those mutations are occurring in a part of the spike protein that's important for those antibodies to bind it, it could make those therapies less useful or effective at treating coronavirus. That is not necessarily true for other antiviral therapies such as remdesivir, which is more broad spectrum and not specific for the spike protein. But what people should also keep in mind is that those monoclonal antibody therapies are not widely available. The vaccine is going to be really, I think, what people should be paying attention to. And vaccines induce multiple types of antibodies. So even if there are some mutations that prohibit binding based on the vaccines that are currently designed, there's always the possibility that those vaccines are inducing other antibodies that will still be effective. So people should not be overly concerned. They should be cautious.
Well, yes, but remain cautious. We've just got 10 seconds. Angela Rasmussen, the virologist with the Georgetown Center for Global Health Science and Security. Christmas is coming. People just have to keep hunkering down until we get past, you know, new strains and the wreckage of the coronavirus. Dr. Rasmussen, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. A resilient city and region relies on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve Greater Boston's most serious problems, from the hardships of COVID to the fight for racial equity and other important issues that affect the lives of everyone in our community. Learn how you can help build a Greater Boston that works for everyone by partnering with the Boston Foundation at tbf.org/partner.
I say Citizen Kane, you might say greatest film ever made. Or Orson Welles, the 25-year-old who in 1940 produced, directed, and starred as Kane, a thinly veiled version of real-life media titan William Randolph Hearst. Well, now you might also say Herman Mankiewicz, the writer commissioned by Orson Welles to write Citizen Kane in the new Netflix film Mank. In this scene, Mank, played by Gary Oldman, shows his wrangler, John Houseman, played by Sam Troughton, his script. Houseman would go on to be an Oscar-winning actor who supported Mank's widow after Mank dies way too young from alcoholism. But these are happier times as Houseman sees Mank's script.
As a moving picture, it's more than good. I'm at a loss to even express how wealth and influence can crush a man. It's Lear, the dark night of the soul.
But, he said, it's too long, to which Mank replies,
I built him a watertight narrative and a suggested destination. Where he takes it, that's his job.
Welles and Herman Mankiewicz would battle over the writing credit for the film, eventually sharing it and an Oscar. A great Hollywood feud, but also a reminder of a great family. Herman's brother Joseph wrote and directed the Academy Award-winning All About Eve. A son, the late journalist Frank Mankiewicz, was a president of NPR who greatly expanded the network and the network's debt years ago. He was also Robert Kennedy's press secretary. Well, today we want to hear from the next generation, Frank's son Ben, a host on Turner Classic Movies, and his son Josh, an NBC reporter. Josh and Ben Mankiewicz, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And let's just get this out of the way. Who wrote Citizen Kane? This film, written by the late Jack Fincher and directed by his son, David, comes down firmly on the side of your grandfather, Mank. But so did critic Pauline Kael in an infamous 1972 essay, after which Peter Bogdanovich came to Orson Welles' defense. And Ben, we know you spoke with Bogdanovich years later, want to hear about that. But Josh, what did you guys hear growing up?
Well, I mean, there wasn't any debate in our house as to who wrote the movie. It was just talked about as this great achievement of our grandfather, who neither of us met. But you sort of heard about mythically your entire life if you're a Mankiewicz. You know, I was prepared for Citizen Kane long before I'd seen it. I mean, I sort of felt like I had seen it by the time I watched it the first time.
Yeah. And Ben, you have a way of framing this.
My framing is that I think that a lot of the Bogdanovich supporters, and Peter, who I adore, that they see what Pauline Kael wrote, that piece, as diminishing Welles' contribution. And so I always say, hey, look, man, Herman wrote most of the screenplay, but it is Orson Welles' movie, produced it in the face of these enormous headwinds, directed it in a way that changed the way movies are directed, and delivered this dazzling performance. It's Orson Welles' movie with a screenplay mostly written and conceived by Herman Mankiewicz, arguably entirely written and then condensed by Welles.
Yeah. Okay, so put that aside. How about the man we meet, Mank? Died in his 50s from the raging alcoholism that was his calling card. But he was also the Berlin correspondent for the Chicago Tribune, the drama critic for the New York Times, and then the first regular drama critic at the New Yorker, script fixer on so many films, The Wizard of Oz, Man of the World, Dinner at Eight, Pride of St. Louis. He made a pretty prescient film against Hitler that no one would produce. He got Jews out of Germany when people in Hollywood we see in the film seemed oblivious. In the film, we see a nod to some of this, but, you know, he kind of was depicted as what some of the studio heads called him, a court jester. Josh, I'm trying to imagine people who love family members who are alcoholics. To them, that is not funny, right? What was that like to watch for you?
The guy in the movie is the guy I always heard about. Brilliant, funny, literate, kind, a mensch, full of self-hate. I mean, the only person that didn't believe he was a great, wonderful, talented guy was Herman. And he sort of took that out on himself. And in the end, he paid for it, and we did too.
Yeah. And I'm imagining you both heard about this your whole life. You know, the grandfather who was brilliant, but also squandered things. It just, Ben, how do you think your dad, Frank Mankiewicz, was affected by this?
Well, first of all, my dad didn't drink. And he didn't really gamble, the two primary sins that destroyed Herman. But mostly, of course, what destroyed Herman was that sort of self-loathing that he didn't think anything he'd contributed mattered. He didn't think these movies mattered. So, you know, I want to go back, and I think my father did too, you know, and especially as I've spent the last 2 decades of my life talking about classic movies, you want to go back in time and shake him and go, hey, man, no, this art form mattered. This was not a popcorn escapism and nothing else. But this is a valuable signature American art form, and he ought to have been enormously proud of it. Clearly, one reason for fighting for the credit on Citizen Kane was that he thought he had finally written something worthwhile, something that mattered.
Mm. I have to say, you know, for some of us, the name Mank that resonates the most is your dad, Herman Mankiewicz's son, Frank, at NPR at the start of Morning Edition, but also for people of a certain age, he was, as Robert Kennedy's press secretary, the man who told America that Kennedy had been assassinated. We have this sound. Let's listen.
Senator Robert Francis Kennedy died at 1:44 a.m. today, June 6, 1968.
Ooh, it still gives me chills.
He was the father that Herman, I think, was not. He was always there. He went to every one of Ben's high school basketball games. He took me out of school to go to campaign events in 1968 and 1972, which was a tremendous education. He made sure that the childhood he didn't have, his kids did have.
Right. And Ben, your grandfather, Herman Mankiewicz, made not only an enemy of Orson Welles, but made an enemy of William Randolph Hearst, the inspiration for Charles Foster Kane in Citizen Kane. Not a pretty picture. But he had a small fender bender, and he was driving drunk. Hearst, you know, using his papers, he was like the Murdoch, Rupert Murdoch, Fox News of his day. That's kind of eerie. he kind of used his empire to take your grandfather down. And your father, do you mind telling that story about what your father did?
Well, yeah. First of all, so people understand William Randolph Hearst, he was much more than Rupert Murdoch. He was, but he was like Rupert Murdoch and CBS and NBC and ABC, all
and Mark
the Washington
Zuckerberg.
Post and the New York Times. And Mark Zuckerberg, right? I mean, he was by far the most powerful media figure of the 20th century. So when my grandfather had this fender bender, the Hearst people at the Beverly Hills Police Department alerted the Hearst paper, and the Examiner put it on the front page, like it was the biggest story in the world. Mm-hmm. This was the 40s, and the trial was on the front page again, like it was, you know, like it was the O.J. Simpson trial. And then my father was at Camp Roberts getting ready to go overseas and fight in the Second World War. My dad would, he said, sprint to the PX where they sold the papers. And the Examiner was the afternoon paper, and he would buy all of the afternoon papers that covered the story about his father drinking and having this accident, and he would throw them away.
I either heard or always believed that my dad buying the newspapers and throwing them away so that others couldn't read them was the inspiration for the scene in Absence of Malice in which Melinda Dillon's character picks up the morning paper off her neighbor's lawns and throws them away so that her story of how she was involved with the Paul Newman character won't get out.
I was just going to say that. It's the Paul Newman trial film. And that's how it struck me, Ben. It's the little kid in your dad trying to clean things up for his dad. That story just breaks my heart. But I know there's a misperception for both of you. You know, Orson Welles came to your father's house when he was a kid, and I think, was it the Marx Brothers? And you also, you know, senators would come by to dinner. So people think you're part of some sort of royalty.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a lot of people at the dinner table who I later saw on the evening news, yes. I mean, I remember going when I was 17, I went on a trip to England, and I went to Pinewood Studios where Joe was shooting Sleuth. And whenever I see Sleuth, I remember that I was on that set and I sat in that chair. But I mean, otherwise, life was pretty much normal.
You know, my dad never put an ounce of pressure on us to do big things, smart things, really was all he was concerned with. But, you know, there was a weight of expectation that just comes with the name. We think that the smartest person in the family was our father, one of the smartest people of his generation. Yeah. And, you know, all those people, all those great people who worked at NPR when he was there from the late 70s into the early 80s, I mean, almost uniformly, they say whenever Frank was in the room, you knew that was the smartest guy in the room. So we had this dad who I sort of just decided at age, you know, 12 or 13, I could be maybe successful in life, but I'm never going to be like my father. You just can't. But that the weight of expectation it never goes away. It still exists now.
Yeah. Well, and more so, I'm guessing, because of this film that's come out. And now I hope people, you know, really understand a little more about what's behind it. We've been talking to Ben and Josh Mankiewicz, grandsons of the late screenwriter Herman Mankiewicz, the subject of the new film Mank, available on Netflix. Just Josh watching it, stomach turning because, oh my gosh, how this is my grandfather. Thrilling, proud, your thoughts watching it?
I would say all of that. I mean, you know, look, it was surreal to see the guy I never met but always heard about suddenly in my living room. I thought the movie was great. You do kind of want to, if you're a Mankiewicz, reach through the screen and slap him. But it was great to be able to finally meet him in a fashion. It was.
It was an incredibly emotional experience. And Fincher told me, he didn't see it as about the credit for Citizen Kane. There's a tremendous amount of focus on that, and I certainly understand. He wanted to tell the story of the screenwriter and how important screenwriting is in Hollywood and this guy's personal struggle to achieve despite this instinct that he didn't deserve to achieve. I don't know, man. He seemed fun and loved by his peers and the people who he alienated, William Randolph Hearst and studio executives. Well, that's not so bad.
Ben, Josh, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
In Washington, the government is transitioning to the new Biden administration. There are preparations underway outside Washington as well. Some states are getting ready for policies the administration might hand down, such as Biden's campaign promise of a ban on new oil and gas drilling on public lands and waters. Wyoming has become increasingly reliant on the resource, with more than half of its production on federal land. Cooper McKim of Wyoming Public Media reports some in the state are preparing.
A legislative committee is discussing the last stages of approval for a major oil and gas project. Committee members like Wyoming State Senator Brian Boner are anxious to finish up.
Especially with everything that we're faced with the potential new administration slowing down permitting for oil and gas, I think it's good to have at least the opportunity or the potential of having an expedited process.
The project would allow 5,000 new oil and natural gas wells to be drilled in Wyoming. But the Interior Department still has to sign a record of decision before Inauguration Day on January 20. And if it doesn't, some fear new drilling could be delayed for years. For now, the ban on federal oil and gas drilling is a Biden campaign promise. But a new report commissioned by the state calculates the possible economic impacts for Wyoming, along with seven other western states, of either a leasing moratorium or drilling ban. Study author and University of Wyoming economist Timothy Considine told the legislative committee,
"It blows a big hole in the Wyoming budget. You know, it's going to make a bad situation even worse."
Within the first 5 years, Considine calculated those states could collectively lose $8 to $10 billion in tax revenue. Wyoming Governor Mark Gordon said Wyoming relies on a cooperative relationship with the federal government.
However, based on some of the comments we have heard from the Biden energy team, that relationship could be headed in a very different direction.
Gordon did not rule out litigation as a possibility. Otherwise, no concrete actions are certain in response to possible restrictions. For those in oil and gas advocacy, legal action is absolutely on the table. Pete Obermuller is president of the Petroleum Association of Wyoming.
We'll make sure that we're fully up to speed on what our options are on all these things in order to protect Wyoming's industry.
Oil and gas companies that produce on federal land appear mixed in their response to a potential ban. Some simply can't imagine it, given the impact on Wyoming. Occidental Petroleum isn't too concerned. CEO Vicki Holub spoke to that on a recent quarterly earnings call.
I believe that there's going to be other things that are much more urgent for soon-to-be President Biden to take on.
Meanwhile, environmentalists active in Wyoming are going on the offensive. Kate Hudson is with the Waterkeeper Alliance.
This coalition of organizations see finally a light at the end of the tunnel, an opportunity for the new administration to stop the bleeding, to stop the leasing of any more public lands.
With a new administration, Hudson says her coalition is preparing to push for big changes on day one, including an executive order ending new lease sales and oil and gas drilling on public land. More than 500 groups have now called for similar action. So, in and around Wyoming, interested parties are honing in on their wish list and their dread list ahead of Inauguration Day, while they wait to see what action, if any, the Biden administration will take. For Here and Now, I'm Cooper McKim.
As we monitor COVID-19 across the country, let's take a closer look at the outbreak in Tennessee, which now tops the U.S. in per capita cases of the coronavirus. Joining us is Blake Farmer, healthcare reporter for Nashville Public Radio. And Blake, the Tennessee Health Commissioner said yesterday that another holiday surge would break the state's hospitals. What is the situation like there now?
Well, when you look at hospitals, you can talk about capacity in terms of percentages, but they just don't tell the whole story. Hospitals are expanding their COVID ICUs. They're turning waiting rooms into patient areas. At least two hospitals in Tennessee have had to call on a government stockpile for ventilators. They've been making it work, and they're doing more than they ever could have imagined earlier this year, but they are really worried about what's next over the next few weeks.
We see that 30% of COVID tests are coming back positive in Tennessee, and yet The governor, Bill Lee, a Republican, continues to refuse a statewide mask mandate. What steps is he taking, if any?
He's really been adamant about not mandating masks. He notes that about 70% of the state is under mask mandates right now, local ones. He argues a statewide mandate could actually backfire. Not sure how it would really make things worse, but he's certainly encouraging local mayors to make that mask mandate at this point. What Governor Lee did last night was ban public gatherings of more than 10 people. Now, there are lots of exceptions, weddings, funerals, religious services. It also doesn't actually restrict private gatherings, even though the governor has said people really need to stay with just their household for the next month, even during the holidays. So these may not sound super strict, but they are some of the first statewide restrictions Tennessee's had since the summer.
Yeah, and speaking of the holidays, Christmas, of course, is on Friday and then New Year's. So if hospitals are struggling right now, are they prepared for what could come?
Oh, man. I mean, the big issue is staffing, not space. The state's even started to run out of options there, though. They thought they'd be able to just fly in traveling nurses and doctors, but they're not available now. They're working all over the country. So they've called on the Medical Reserve Corps in the state, which I'm not sure I even knew existed before this. They've even talked to students, like maybe a registered nurse who went back to be a nurse practitioner, to ask them to spend their Christmas break picking up shifts.
Wow.
And state health officials say they're just looking under every rock to find help until vaccines kick in.
Blake Farmer from Nashville Public Radio, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, later today, Congress is expected to pass a $900 billion coronavirus relief package, sending billions of dollars to struggling train and bus systems around the country. Patrick Foy is CEO of the New York Metropolitan Transportation Authority, which will receive $4 billion from Congress. Patrick, welcome. And what's your reaction to lawmakers finally passing this bill? It sounds like New York City's subways, trains, and commuter rails were on the brink of disaster.
Had we not gotten this federal aid, and obviously it's got to pass later today and be signed into law, which everybody expects will happen, we would have been faced with a situation where our hand would have been forced and we would have had to reduce subway and bus service by 40% and commuter rails by 50% and lay off about 9,000 colleagues.
So at this point, does that mean those layoffs are just not going to happen?
So the $4 billion included for the MTA in the COVID relief bill will cover our deficit for 2021. That'll give us a year's running room. We will not have to cut service as we have described or lay off our colleagues in 2021. Having said that, we still face massive deficits in 2022, 23, 24. And our ask following this $4 billion to the federal government is $8 billion in federal funding over that period.
Yeah. Okay. So just paint the picture for us about how badly the situation was at the MTA. Your ridership numbers were down and your finances very badly hurt by the pandemic.
Clearly, let me put it in context, Peter. The decline in ridership on subways, buses, Metro North and Long Island Railroad, the two commuter rails that we also run, orders of magnitude worse than the Great Depression. At the depths of the pandemic, subway ridership was down 95%. And even right now, on an average weekday, it's down 70 to 75% compared to an average pre-pandemic weekday. We get half our revenues from our customers in fares and tolls. And the precipitous decline in ridership across the board has had drastic adverse financial consequences.
So this would explain why your financial picture was so dire. But as you say, you still have an $8 billion hole to fill, even with the relief money down the road. So that means you either have to raise more revenue, cut expenses, or both. How are you going to do that?
The answer is we're going to have to do all three. And by all three, I mean ask for and make the case for additional federal funding for the MTA. We believe that the MTA's recovery is pivotal to the New York regional economy's recovery. Our region accounts for about 10% of national GDP, so it's in the nation's interest to do that. Second is we are going to have to raise fares and tolls. And the third thing is cutting costs. And over the last several years, we've taken $2.8 billion of cost out. In 2021, we'll take an additional, I estimate, $800 million out. At the beginning of the year, in January, a couple of months before the pandemic, we expected an $80 million surplus for the year. And the only way we're able to close it this year is with Federal Reserve municipal liquidity funding borrowing, and then next year it'll be covered by the funding for the MTA and the COVID relief bill.
On the issue of raising fares, I know, I'm sure you're aware that this weekend commuters were protesting that plan. They're making the argument that they're being asked to pay more at a time when the economy is absolutely devastating, and the fact that they're getting less from the service. So is now the time to be raising fares on your commuters when they're hurting the most?
Look, we're acutely aware that lots of our neighbors in the New York region are suffering, underemployed, unemployed, making less money. Small businesses, including restaurants, have been hit very hard. The difficulty that we have at the MTA is fares and tolls account for 50% of our revenue. There's over $300 million of annual fare revenue, toll and fare revenue, built into our budget and increases over a period of time. We propose to increase it less than the rate of inflation. And for low-income New Yorkers, the city of New York has a Fair Fares program. There ought to be more people enrolled in it. But for customers, low-income customers, the Fair Fares option funded by the city of New York is an important option.
We've been talking about finances, but of course, there's also the human toll of this pandemic, and it's taken its toll on the MTA. I think the virus has killed more than 100 of your workers. How difficult has this year been for you and all the people working there?
New York was the epicenter of the virus in March and April, and it exacted a heavy toll in New York City and the region. Obviously, Governor Cuomo's done extraordinary things in terms of stopping the spread. But the effect on our colleagues at the MTA has been devastating. We created a family benefit for the survivors of transit workers who passed away due to the to COVID. We thought it's first in the nation, I believe, and we thought it was the right thing to do. We've led the way in terms of innovating, working with antimicrobials and air exchange programs and ultraviolet C light, which we proved with a professor from Columbia eradicates the COVID-19 virus. Distributed millions of masks to our employees and our customers. We'll continue to do that going forward. But the virus has exacted a very heavy toll, including at the MTA, and we grieve and mourn the loss of every one of our colleagues.
Does the arrival of the vaccine change your projection of when you can return to some kind of normal?
The announcement of multiple vaccines is extraordinary news, and ridership will come back. The trends driving ridership, urbanization, environmental considerations. Obviously, mass transit is extraordinarily green compared to getting in a car and driving on a highway. The fact that human beings want to socialize. And lastly, if you look at the 1819 flu pandemic and the smallpox vaccine in 1947, the polio situation in the late 50s and 60s, people have returned to mass transit in ever greater numbers. We expect that to continue. It is not going to come back immediately. And the reduction in ridership, which will be less dramatic than it was in the worst days of the pandemic in New York in March and April and May, ridership will increase, but it's going to take some time to get back to those record levels.
Patrick Foy is chairman and CEO of the New York Metropolitan Transportation Authority, otherwise known as the guy who runs the New York City subway system. Patrick, thank you so much for your time and best of luck.
Thank you, Peter.
Trucks waiting to get out of Britain are backed up for miles and people are stranded at airports as dozens of countries around the world ban arrivals from the UK over concerns about a new, more infectious strain or variant of the coronavirus called B117. British Health Secretary Matt Hancock says the new strain is out of control around London and in parts of England, but experts are also urging caution. They say the new strain appears to be more infectious, but it's not clear if it's also more deadly than the coronavirus that's killed more than a million people worldwide. Still, there's concern. What will its impact be on vaccines, on known treatments? So countries are clamping down at borders. Let's go to a service area in Kent in southeast England where this new variant, the B117, has spiked. And hundreds of trucks that normally cross from England to France every day on ferries or through the Euro Channel tunnel, the channel, are stuck. Rick Mayo is one of them. He's a British trucker, but he moved to Spain a few years ago to to save money. He's stranded now at the service center in England because he's trying to make his way home through Europe. He joins us on his cell phone. And Rick, when this news started to spread about this new form of coronavirus, it's possibly spreads faster than the first. As a truck driver who has to be on the road, what were your thoughts?
It didn't really affect us a great deal because when the coronavirus first started with us, we were going up and down through Spain, France, Germany, etc. throughout Europe, keeping the supply chains going. So we just carried on going. We didn't stop. Just had to be extra cautious. Gloves, masks, etc. Loads of bottles of disinfectant and loads of bottles of antiseptic, etc. like that you keep in the cab as you do. The new virus, we were taking the same precautions. You still got to keep the supply chains going.
Well, but as you know, a lot of countries are saying not through our country. I mean, they are blocking specifically Britain at this point. What are you seeing as you look around at this rest stop?
Many, many lorries parked up, not being able to go anywhere. A lot of Eastern Europeans, French, well, no French, but basically a lot. There's not many English coming over because it's too near Christmas. Because I live in Spain, though, I'm looking to get back abroad or back over into Europe to get down into Spain. The longer it goes on, I mean, it's doubtful I'll get home for Christmas now because from where I am, it's 3.5 days home. I'm one of the lucky ones, in all honesty. At least I'm in a service area with facilities, food, showers, toilets, etc. Shops there at the services. A lot of the guys are parked down on the motorway, and there's no facilities, no food, nothing. They're the guys that are struggling. They didn't get any. They might have had warnings on the motorway, but basically a lot of them were already down there because of the delays on the tunnel. When it finally shut down, they were stuck. End of story.
Yeah. You're stuck there as a trucker, but there's some irony here because Brexit is coming, the UK breaking with the EU, but there's no deal. So there was concern that in several days when Brexit kicks in, there was also, you know, going to be a huge backup at the border. Are you afraid that you'll go from a, you know, new variant of coronavirus backup to a Brexit backup?
My belief is, I can't call people liars, but my belief is a lot of this is political anyway. I believe a lot of this is France making a protest against Brexit. And that's my belief. It's not a fact. It's only a belief that I've got. There's a lot of people in the same sort of opinion because the way the EU are actually treating the UK at the moment, it's not fair. They're demanding they're going to give us 27% of our own fishing waters and they want the rest. And it's our waters. You think, well, are you crazy? And we're stuck. This is where we're getting no deals. And that's where a lot of it stems from.
Well, you know, Rick, I hear you, and I know yours is not the only voice that thinks this, but I'm thinking, boy, you know, if politics gets in here, we're familiar with this in the U.S., you know, who do you trust? Because, you know, the officials are saying that this is a serious variant of this coronavirus. They want to block it from crossing borders. You're saying you're skeptical of that. I understand your thinking, but does that mean you don't believe that this strain is that serious?
No, it's all serious. Don't get me wrong there. No, there's something about it. But during the first coronavirus, when it first came in and the first complete lockdown, so there was a European lockdown, and the only people that were on the roads were trucks. And people on first hand, like nurses, police, firemen, etc. Those on the front line were on the road, and obviously truck drivers keeping the supply chains going. And we were going through all the borders, and we were going through there with very little delay. But with this one, my belief is it's a bit of a protest from France. I think there's a lot of politics involved, myself, which is probably something, as you say, you Americans are probably used to.
Well, we're sorry you are caught in the middle of this. Rick Mayo, he's a truck driver, a lorry driver, stuck in southeast England on the border because the French have closed that border over new concerns about a new variant of coronavirus.
Yeah.
Rick, best of luck to you, and Merry Christmas. I hope you don't spend it at a truck stop.
Me too. There's a saying in England, it is what it is.
We have that saying here as well. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. An annual survey of threatened and endangered species has some startling news. About a third of all oak tree species on the planet are on the brink of extinction. That's next time on Here and Now.